Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Terry. This morning, Jaws of Justice programmer Keith Brownell will have a talk with Clifford Miller, an inmate at Western Missouri Correctional Center. Clifford believes he's innocent of the charges that hold him in prison, and he will speak on his experience with the criminal justice system. Across our country, thousands of people have been wrongfully convicted in a system defined by official indifference to innocence and error. There are more innocent people in our jails and prisons today than ever before, and the rate of exonerations continues to rise, which reveals an unreliable system of criminal justice. That includes a lack of accountability for police and prosecutors, reliance on junk science and mistaken eyewitnesses, and the indigent defense crisis as major contributors to wrongful convictions that have undermined the credibility of our system and ruined the lives of innocent men and women. After our calendar, we will have a replay of our January 20 show with Gaddafi, a.k.a. James Shelby, who has been incarcerated in Missouri for over 22 years. While inside, Gaddafi was active with the NAACP prison branches, and he helped found the Missouri chapter of IWW's Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, IWOC. Since his release last year, Gaddafi has continued to be a leader in the struggle. He worked with KC Tenants to pass legislation that prevents landlords from discriminating against felons in housing. He founded his own nonprofit, Hug Ya Hood. He has worked as a community advocate for Elad Gross's campaign for Attorney General of Missouri. Stay tuned to hear us talk with Gaddafi about his activism, contributions, and insights to the movement as a formerly incarcerated person. Please stay tuned. Jaws of Justice wants our listeners to know we appreciate each and every one of you. A crisis on the scale of the pandemic can reorder society in dramatic ways, for better or worse. All of society pays a heavy price for decades of failing to create a rational system of health care that works for all of us. Please take care. We will air the 420 drug war news at the end of our program. Let's listen now to Keith Brownell's interview with Clifford Miller.
What is your name, sir?
My name is Clifford Miller, Clifford S. Miller.
What city are you from?
Kansas City, Missouri, Jackson County.
And where are you now?
I'm here now at Cameron, Western Missouri Correctional Center.
Can you tell us how you ended up there?
Back in 1992, there was an offense committed on a female black woman in the Kansas City area. She was supposed to be assaulted and robbed. This happened back in June 19 of 92.
And what are the details? Just walk us through your story and the events.
Okay, the details came from on that night in question, at Jimmy's Steakhouse located on 29th and Prospect, a woman was supposed to have been abducted and assaulted. She left the club. She was there with her friend, but she left the club by herself to wait on her friend across on the parking lot before a black male suspect, her assailant, pulled up and said some things about her purse, and then he supposed to have pulled out a gun, and there was a struggle over the gun, and it went off, and he supposed to have hit her in the elbow, and then he forced her into a car and took her to an unknown location where she was demanded to perform all sex on him. Again, this happened in 1992. There was no suspect at the time, and 1 year later, I became a suspect. I seen the victim at a club on 18th and Vine called Al Capitan, and I had asked her to dance, and once she danced with me, she looked at me and stated, "Where do I know you from?" So I told her that, you know, I don't know, I said, but if you're, you know, out clubbing, that, you know, I'm a clubber and I'm a DJ, so she may have seen me at a club. And when she started to ask him what clubs, I particularly was naming a lot of clubs in the metropolitan area, but when I did say Jimmy's Steakhouse, she became frantic and she stopped dancing and went to the table where her other friends were and told them that I was the guy that assaulted and robbed her, shot her last year. The police was called, but when they came to talk with me, they didn't place me under arrest. They actually just wanted to, you know, make contact for my name and in case anybody wanted to talk to me further. So as this incident went on, I gave them the information, they went to their car and they did a police, surveillance on me or however they called it, and data. Well, when the officer came back to me, he said it was coincidental that the address that I gave him came back to where this victim was found at. But in all actuality, the address that I gave him was not the one that was in the police data. So therefore, he just said it was coincidental and that I'm not under arrest and, pretty much let me go. Well, maybe 3 or 4 months later, the victim had changed her story and said that she was not robbed and gave conflicting stories to the detectives. So they reclassified it to a robbery, but however, she gave other conflicting statements saying that she was sexually assaulted, which was sodomized, and therefore, this is what I was charged with. Now, the evidence in the case as it came along, it was due to a vehicle that the suspect had driven the night of the incident. Well, the woman identified the vehicle as a gray over black Trans Am or a Camaro, and said it was old and rusted. So I told the attorney that I hired to defend me for this case that, I had a car that was a Camaro, but it was blue. It was nothing described as the victim. So he'd asked me to go get the police report, which was deemed Kansas City, Missouri Police Department, and it showed that my car was blue. But when he gave it, turned the police report over to the prosecuting attorney, the prosecuting attorney, in turn, slashed the lady that I was involved in that accident with in on the first day of trial and somehow got her to say that the car that I was involved in an accident with her was a gray car.
Okay, now tell me about this accident. When did this occur?
This accident occurred 2 weeks before the reported crime that occurred. It happened in May because they went to March. So it was probably like 3 or 4 months before the incident occurred. This accident happened in front of my house where I stayed at. The lady that was involved in the car accident with me, she was at a house across the street from me visiting a friend of hers, and I was backing out my driveway, and I hit her car on the driver's side door. The police came and took a report and everything.
This call is from a correctional facility and may be monitored and recorded.
That day, and like I say, the report was deemed to show, that I had a blue car, blue Camaro, and like I said, the report was given to my attorney to refute the description of the victim's description of the car.
Okay, now what happened after that?
Okay, after that, and I'm going to go take back to, again, the evidence. The victim was supposed to have been found at this address, which, as I mentioned before, where they said the address came back to me, but it didn't, and no crime occurred there. So the prosecuting attorney used this as evidence, to convict me, saying that it had came back to me. My trial attorney never investigated who stayed at the residence where the victim was found. And the police department never investigated to whom stayed at the house where the victim was found. So therefore, it went unchallenged during the course of trial. But at this point in time right now, I have an affidavit from the resident who stayed there wanting to testify that no crime happened at her home, and I by no means stayed there at that address.
Okay. So none of this came out in court?
This house and this car.
So, okay, your three main issues are the house, to which no crime ever occurred in, according to the persons who lived at the house. Did they specify that they were living there at that time?
Yes, they did.
Okay. And what your second issue is what?
Is the description of the car.
The description of the car.
Yeah. The prosecuting attorney solicited this false testimony and slash evidence to the jury, as opposed to the lady that I was involved in the car accident with. And again, she stated that the color of my car was gray. But now I have an affidavit from her also wanting to recant her testimony, as she knows that the police report was deemed and it was, the color was blue. The key issue to it also is that this witness was never endorsed by the state or my attorney. So therefore, she popped up on the day of trial and gave this false testimony.
Well, I don't know if you're aware of this, and I want to state this so that everybody else listening will also know. When a witness gives a statement to the police, the police and the courts, they go by whatever the witness told them when they first gave the statement. And it's almost impossible to have that statement retracted once they give the initial statement. You know, you have people come before the courts all the time, and they keep saying, well, hey, I made a mistake. You know, after they've had a little time to sit down and actually think about it and process everything. Sometimes when you give your first statement, it's not the best statement you can give, you know, because you're confused and a lot of things. They don't take that under consideration. If you make a confession to the police when you are arrested, it's almost impossible to get that confession retracted, even if it's evidence showing that you didn't do it. But their theory is that your memory is more accurate and precise when the incident first happened than, you know, it is later on when you have had an opportunity to recall certain things. So what happened in your appeal process?
During the course of my appeal, this evidence or the claims and grounds was never raised. And I, during that course of my appeals, I was always denied review of it, even when I got the affidavits. And it's up to this day that I've always been denied my appeals. They were all unsuccessful, so and never adjudicated on the merits for the review of, you know, the claims that I was putting in. But I would like to state for the record also is that I had a neighbor also that came to testify for me that he saw me at my house at the time the crime was committed. Well, his name, as I knew of it, was Jimmy Burge. He stayed right across the street from me diagonally about a couple of houses down. And I told my trial attorney to speak with him. And he would tell him just so that I just mentioned. And my trial attorney said that he went by his home, but he or his intern never got out to talk to anyone. Well, I told my trial attorney, and I believe this was maybe the second day of trial or towards the end of the trial, that he needed to speak with this guy. And when he did, and they put the guy on the stand the next morning, he said his name was Jimmy Briggs. So the prosecuting attorney objected to his testimony as not being endorsed as a witness on the witness list, but he decided to speak with this guy to see what he would testify to. And, of course, he gave his testimony, as just as I mentioned, and so the prosecuting attorney told the court that he would object to him testifying in the presence of the jury, but he'll put his testimony on for the record.
And his name was actually Jimmy Verge, not Jimmy.
His name was actually Jimmy Verge, but it's Jimmy Briggs. It's like a marriage mate. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Now, did he tell them that, or was that just a typo or something in the clerk's records or what?
No, this was a poor investigation, basically, on my attorney. And I would also mention the state because, again, my attorney, I gave him the only name that I knew him by in the address. So when my attorney, again, went by his house to talk to him, he never got out to see if the guy was there. So when the guy came in to testify and gave him the other name, which, like I say, was his alias of Munker, that my attorney subpoenaed him up under that name. But had he looked on the witness list that was given to him, he would have seen that Jimmy Verge is the same person as Jimmy Briggs. And by the subpoena's address and the address that I gave him to talk to this witness, he would have known then that there was an incorrect name given in court, not in the on the witness list. And that's how they got me. They faulted me for not alerting my counsel that Jimmy Briggs was Jimmy Verge.
Now, was this a public defender or a paid attorney? Not that it matters.
No, this was a retained counsel. He was a paid attorney. And I'd like to also mention for the record that I have an affidavit from this attorney looking back in hindsight stating that, you know, this was a mistake on his part and that I am actually innocent of all the charges against me and that, you know, his firm belief is that I should get appellate relief and or pardoned by the government.
Okay, now you said your appeal never went to the appeals court. He never filed an appeal in your favor?
By trial counsel?
Yeah.
No, he couldn't. It would have been a conflict of interest.
So, to this day, you've never had your case heard on appeal?
I never had my case heard on appeal except for what I just mentioned about the appeal process consisted of two processes. The trial attorney abuses discretion in not allowing this witness to testify before the jury, and the ineffectiveness of my counsel not to have investigated and interviewed this witness. But as the appeal went through for its conclusion after review, the courts faulted me for not advising counsel that Jimmy Briggs was Jimmy Verge. And that the court did not abuse his discretion and not allow this late-endorsed witness to testify.
You didn't know his name was Jimmy Briggs, right? You knew him as Jimmy Verge.
Yeah, I only knew him as Jimmy Verge.
Uh huh. Well, I've read cases that directly contradict that. As long as you give the lawyer the information that he needs to investigate the matter and find out. It doesn't matter if you gave him the right name or not. You know, that's up to the counsel to determine whether or not, you know, the information he's been given is correct. But, you know, things are different now than they were several years ago or many years ago. I think it's just outrageous that they let some of these attorneys get away with some of the stuff that they pull. I mean, you cannot hardly get a case ruled on in your favor for ineffective assistance of counsel. You know, and that was one of the things that was really big a number of years ago. You know, but you just can't get an effective assistance of counsel claim through the courts anymore. You know, and I try to make people understand that they make a big thing. A lot of people make a big thing about having paid lawyers. The research shows that public defenders do just as good as paid lawyers do in court. You know, in some cases, you might get better representation. Not in all cases, but the problem that they have is that you've got too many lawyers. They got too much work to do, and they just basically interested in just running people through there, and doing whatever the minimum amount of work is that the law requires. And in some cases, they don't even do that. Now, Did your lawyer, at the end of your trial, did he tell the court that he felt like his representation of you was inadequate?
Yes, he actually did tell them that when they questioned me about his representation. And of course, I told him everything. I told him he failed to talk to my witnesses because I had alibi witnesses, and he never talked to them until the day before trial, which that would have been a Sunday. Trial started on a Monday. So during the course of, I believe, was 6 months before we went to trial, there was never an investigation done by him or the state of Missouri. Again, he did not, you know, speak of his ineffectiveness, but once that I got sentenced and came to prison is when he had a change of mind. He told me personally over the phone that he and his office had made a big mistake on me, and that
this call is from a correctional facility and may be monitored and recorded.
That they were liable for what happened to me and for me to attack him. I have the documentation in black and white to show that too. So that's what I started doing after I learned, you know, that his representation was ineffective. So at that point is where I actually started attacking his ineffective. But no, he did not mention to the court that his representation was failure. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so at what point did he tell you this? What stage of your fighting your conviction were you in when he came and told you all of this?
At this stage, we were at the post-conviction proceeding. And in the post-conviction proceeding is when he actually came out and spoke of his strategic ineffectiveness, that he made a mistake strategically about not objecting to the witness of the victim, I mean the witness of the state, whom testified that my car was gray. He said he should have objected to that witness and that police officer because they were late endorsed witness by the state too. They was never on the witness list or in the discovery. He also mentioned about the home that because he did not investigate the home is because of the closeness of the relationship of the woman who stayed across the street from my grandmother, and that we may have known each other, so therefore he did not want to, you know, interview her, which to me was a bad strategic reason because of the simple fact it's regardless of whether she was my neighbor or what may have you, she had testimony and evidence that no crime was committed at her home and that I never stayed there.
Well, you have a very interesting story to tell, and I hope that our audience has learned something today and gained some insight into how unfairly a lot of people are treated when they are facing criminal charges. I wish you all the luck in the world in having your conviction overturned. I hope there's some way you can get back in the courts or prevail upon the governor to issue you a pardon in this case, because it's pretty obvious that, you know, you got railroaded. This happens every day. So we thank you for sharing our story with you. And, you know, we hope you have better luck on trying to challenge your appeal than you had in the initial prosecution.
Okay. And I appreciate you all, too.
All right. Thank you, sir.
All right.
Now the calendar for the week of April 6th. In compliance with the local instruction, all live meetings are suspended until all clear is given by the mayor. Usually, Corey's Network would have their weekly meeting with a survivors workshop on Monday from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Church of the Four Corners, the City House in Independence, Missouri. This week, Corey's Network is on Facebook or their website, corey'snetwork.org. The Criminal Justice Task Force hopes everyone is staying safe during this COVID-19 pandemic. They will have a conference call type meeting for this April on Monday 4-6 at 6:45 p.m. If you have questions or concerns about what's going on or want to get updates on legislation, please call in at 605-313-5573, and when prompted, enter access code 954-777. You may hear music before you're connected. This is a free call unless your cell phone plan says otherwise. You can use home phones. For information, contact Robin Johnson at 816-522-4081 or email redrob2655@yahoo.com. Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty will have their April meeting by email on Tuesday, April 7, from 6:30 to 8 p.m. Go to madpmo.org for contact information. Moms Demand Action Johnson County, Kansas virtual meeting will be Thursday, April 9th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. This is an online conference call from your own phone. Go to momsdemandaction.org to RSVP. Moms Demand Action Kansas Wyandotte County virtual meeting will be Saturday, April 11th, 10 a.m. to noon. This is an online conference call. Go to momsdemandaction.org to RSVP. You can join the virtual meeting on Zoom from your home. They will train and discuss phone banking and the upcoming elections. You can bring your favorite ideas for self-care. All are welcome, mothers and others. Next Monday, April 13th, mothers of incarcerated sons and daughters will have an online meeting. If you have a loved one that's incarcerated and need advice and support, mothers of incarcerated sons and daughters have members that may be able to help. Go to misdkc.org for more information. My name is Terry, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn.
Okay, good morning. Thank you all so much for listening today to KKFI. And I am here in the studio live with James Shelby, a.k.a. Gaddafi, who is going to talk with us today a little bit about his leadership and his activism in Kansas City. As you heard in the intro, Gaddafi is a formerly incarcerated individual, spent 22 plus years inside in Missouri in different prisons. And so let's kind of start there. We only have 30 minutes and you've done so much. Tell me a little bit about your leadership and how you grew into your activism while you were incarcerated.
When I first got to prison, I learned that prisoners ran prisons. And the corrections officers at the time, it was guards, you know, they really just allowed us to do what we did as long as we didn't try to escape. Killing each other was okay. Extorting each other was okay as long as we did it to each other. And I learned that, you know, prisoners ran the prison, and I figured that if anybody gonna run it, it might as well be me. So I started learning, you know, grooming myself to run the prison, you know, so to speak. When I first got to prison, I couldn't read or spell. I was totally illiterate, so I snuck and taught myself how to read, spell, and that was my weakest point. By the time I left, that was my strongest point. Eventually, I started getting locked up for helping people do grievances and legal work and, you know, regain they freedom, people who shouldn't have been there. And I got more gratification out of building people up rather than tearing them down. I found myself, you know, and so I helped people, you know, become bigger, better, stronger, and more efficient and learn how to do the right thing and get the most out of their self. You know, by doing for others, it enhances you rather than tearing you down.
Great. That's some really good insight. So I heard that you were integral in starting the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee while you were inside. And they're part of the IWW. We have a really strong branch here in Kansas City. So can you tell me a little bit about that? I'm curious on how that organizing went.
When I first heard of IWW, I heard it was a little thing that was getting ready to start. Some people thought it was a dating service.
What?
And for real, it was like, hey, this is where little white girls will write you and you could catch and get money sent to you. And I thought it was cute, but I seen that they was trying to do something. And I, you know, out of curiosity, I decided to see what they listen. And I wrote Brianna and told her to revamp that, that it wasn't going to work and people was, she was going to receive this type of mail and these type of people was getting ready to start hollering. And then she listened. She put out a thingy saying that she was trying to revamp and she'd get back with people. And she did. And then after she did that, I felt inclined to do my part. So I start enlisting people to get involved because can't know anybody just break in and get involved with us. We don't trust people. Mm-hmm. People don't just look out for us or help us. They have an ulterior motive. And we learn that, and so we don't. We just don't deal with no anybody. And but Brianna was actually genuine in trying to start something and do what she did. And I had also heard from a guy named Lorenzo. I mean, what's his name?
Lamont?
Huh? Yeah, but I had heard him. I mean, he was trying to do this Black Federation thing, and you know, and he had said, you know, put in a good word for Brianna, and so from that, I kind of knew that she was a good activist, just didn't know how to deal with hardcore prisoners. So I started recruiting prisoners from every prison, you know, back. Then I used to be somebody, so people trust my word. You know, when I say this is a good group, get involved, people did, and they did in crowds. You know, and I tried to make sure it wasn't just a person here, a person there. I recruited hundreds, thousands of people and helped jump it off, and I liked it.
Yeah, and they still stay pretty busy with those hundreds and thousands
of people. Yes, they do. They still write every Sunday. They do a write prisoners. It's a lot of people should be involved because almost everybody got somebody that's been to prison or in prison. And most of those people be looking for advocacy groups that could help them outside of their families. And quiet as it's kept, IWOC, Brianna Nell, actually advocate on their behalf. They write people, they call people, they ask people what they need, and they call people. If you got a person in jail, Brianna is probably looking out for them more so than you are because she's an organization and she digs in and she answers their literature and she don't get enough help. Very few people volunteer. Everybody that got somebody there should be trying to figure out how to help enhance what she do because IWOC is the stuff. There were times where I got locked up for nothing and didn't have nobody I could call on, you know, no organizational strength or power. Sometimes they ignore family. And when I got with her, they got on the phone, they advocated, and they put me out, you know, they literally like put me out of the hole because darkness can't stand no light. And so when she shined light on the situation, they released me, and that was on more than one occasion. Almost every time I got in some trouble, I, Brianna, help, again, some more. And they treat you different. When you have outside support, they don't dog you out as bad, and everybody needs somebody in their life so as to not to get dogged out because they treat people really, 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 really bad, and they experiment on us. And if you don't have no outside support, you get the worst, you know.
I think that's kind of a little hidden gem that people don't know much about. So IWOC, Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, KC, you can find them on Facebook. You should definitely, you could check out their meetings, but they do phone zaps, they do calls, they will send letters on to governors, and it is very important work in the struggle.
Not so. Only that, they answer all the mail for the prisoners in Texas and other places that they don't have nobody to help advocate for them. They awesome. You know, I'm like, damn, when I grew up, I want to be just like them.
Well, I can tell that they're awesome because they gained your trust and got your support, and they got 100%. Connected to the people that needed the help the most. And that's work that you're continuing to do. You've been out here for, what, 5 months now?
Five whole months.
It feels like 5 years with the At amount you've accomplished. Years. So talk to me a little bit about what you've been doing in the struggle since you've been out.
Well, when I first got out, Brianna took me to a few places. She took me to KC Tenants. I joined, got in where I fitted in. She took me to this little thingy about, what's that, Missourians Against Death Penalty. And I'm like, I'm in on that. She took me to a green party thingy, and I'm like, I'm in on that. You know, every place she took me, I joined, and I'm active, you know, still active. You know, she's like my mentor. You know, I respect a gangster, that's all.
Right on. You made waves in KC Tenants. You made waves, and you are not unfamiliar with the reentry struggle in housing for people. So tell me a little bit about the accomplishments that you've helped push through with KC Tenants for felons and formerly incarcerated people in housing.
I don't see where I helped much. I just got in where I fit in. Yeah. They started before me, you know, in February. I got out in August, and when I went there, I figured I could help, but I don't have no skill set that you could put on paper, but I do have a unique set of skills that I know how to utilize. You know, I'm a people person, and I know how to motivate people, you know, to get in where they fit in, and everything with me is personal. You know, they do one-on-ones with people. And I'm like, I understand that. I've been doing that all my life in prison. Uh-oh, somebody's calling the cavalry.
Uh-oh, no, that's my finger off.
No, I'm trying to throw it away. Okay, come on, keep on.
He's in demand, folks.
All right,
we're lucky to have him here on the show today.
All right, I'm ready.
Okay, so talk KC Tenants. You said they were moving and moving forward, and you get in where you fit in.
No, I got in where I fit in, and it helped reacclimate me back into society, having something to do, and that's key. A lot of times we get out and people kick us to the curb. You know, I couldn't get a job, I couldn't get a place to stay. I was living out of my car. I still am living out of my car. It ain't as bad now as it was at first. It was a lot coming at me after 22 years. Everything was different. I didn't know nobody. I was homeless the second day after I got out, and it was overwhelming. KC Tenants helped reacclimate me just by having something to do. A lot of people came at me and said I should have got paid for what I was doing. Other people get paid for doing the type of work, and I was all in. I was not part-time. I was on a mission. I was one of those 24 hours, 7 days a week type of people. And, you know, that's all I did. I declined jobs because it would have taken away from doing that and different stuff. And I continued to, you know, live how I had to in order to do what I wanted to do. And I wanted to do KC Tenants. I said I was going to see it through that portion of it, and I did. And, you know, it was, like I said, I didn't get paid, but I grew, you know, and that was my payment. I grew. I met people. I got a chance to do what I do best, you know. I had a unique set of skills.
You do, and I love the pictures I see of you with the mayor and with the city council people, and that it's I think it's great to see you interacting and building relationships like that.
That ain't the best part, being on the pictures with mayors and city councilmen. Now, if they not on a picture with me, they ain't standing on nothing. I'm standing on that. If they ain't got no flick with me, they ain't nobody. You know, they better get in where they fit in, holler at a player, get your picture. But anyway, no, the best part about that is prisoners heard I was out, you know, where they watching, and they got together and put together their little funds and sent me a few $100 out of prison.
Oh, wow.
That meant more to me than anything else, you know. You know, they watching, and they say I represent what they can do. You know, it's like hope.
Yeah.
Everybody want hope, you know.
Yeah.
And that was the best part of everything that I done. People in my situation is watching, and they feel like they got a brighter day ahead. If, you know, they could see light at the end of the tunnel, you know, and they say, I represent that. That's awesome.
Yeah, that is very awesome and very powerful to know that you're bridging that for so many people. And
now they want to come out. They want to do something different. It's just that society holds them back and tell them they can't and won't allow them to. Tell them they've been convicted and they stay convicted forever, ever. You know, I get told that on a regular, that I've been convicted and I can't be all that I could be because I paid my debt to society so much so until they let me out. But I'm still condemned over and over in some shape, form, or fashion. And that's what prisoners go through. People that's homeless don't want to be homeless. A lot of them are prisoners, and a lot of them have mental health issues. Mm-hmm. And people just kick them to the curb when they need help, and they're not receiving it. You know, most of the money that the city and state, go to rich communities, rich white communities. And the poor side of town look like the slum area. The people that need it the most get the least. The people that need it the least get the most. And it's everywhere, you know. And until we figure out how to correct the problem, it's going to continue to get worse because usually the people in power cater to the rich, you know. And the poor get poor and they get less and less and get treated worse and worse. Yeah. And somebody got to do something. That's why I'm here and I'm fully activated. And that's why I incorporated Hug Your Hood, and I'm getting ready to get started. And I'm going to get busy, and ain't nobody over Hug Your Hood but me.
There you go.
You know, and there's no bureaucratical stuff, you know. And I'm going to do what I see fit, you know, as far as helping people, charity, reducing violence. I'm going to recruit whole gangs. I'm going to recruit ex-prisoners. I'm going for the people on the bottom of the totem pole, and we're going to do better, you know. We're not just going to sit down and go along to get along and let people continue to mistreat us. You know, we're going to grassroots our way up. You know, if ain't nobody going to help us, we're going to help ourselves.
There you go. To remind our listeners, you're listening to KKFI.org, Kansas City's Community Radio. We are here with Gaddafi wishing you happy Martin Luther King Day as well. So, Gaddafi, you mentioned Hug Your Hood.
Right.
Talk to me. Tell me about your vision. Tell me about your mission. It is huge and powerful and all-encompassing. So talk to me about that.
Hug Your Hood is a subsidiary of New Impact. New Impact is the mothership, and it does everything. New Impact was designed to create solutions. I listen to radio shows and talk shows and stuff and things, and everybody analyze things down to a fine science, but nobody never said, hey, come on, let's do this, or let's go. You know, they just intellectualize stuff, but nobody came up with solutions. So I came up with all solutions. While I was there, I created a little something for everything. Hug Your Hood, Ceasefire, the Fact Force, Family Advocacy Community Task Force, Youth Empowerment System, poll people observing the elderly. I got something already, curriculum, everything, down for everything. I just decided to come out with Hug Your Hood first because everybody is in the hugging their hood. They call it repping their hood or pumping the hood, but it's all hugging the hood, and the hood is people. And that's why I could jump in and get with KC Tenants, because tenants are people in the hood. You know what I'm saying? And anything got anything to do with hood or people in the hood or concerning the hood, I'm in. It don't have to be all about me. I put Hug Your Hood on the back burner when I got out and got with KC Tenants because it was about the hood. And when KC Tenants took a break, then I start doing, trying to put Hug Your Hood together and get it together legit and do all that little stuff and dotting the I's, crossing the T's. I need a little help. Can't find it, but I'm working on it. I could do other things, you know, because as long as it's helping the people, that's all that matters. I'm down for the people. You know, I'm old school. I'm all in or not in at all. And then anybody that's genuine, that's genuinely helping people, I'm on their team, you know.
So what does it mean to, like, hug your hood or rep in your neighborhood? What kind of activities
I'm going to get with people in the hood. I'm going to get try to get a Hug Your Hood headquarters in every community. I'm going to try to create help create autonomous neighborhoods to where the people in the hood, the people closest to the problem is the closest to the solution. So I'm going to recruit the people in the hood and delegate authority to them. Get a Hug Your Hood headquarters in every community, and they going to look out for their own hood. We're going to clean up, take care of, resolve our own conflict. We're going to do whatever we need to do. We're going to do charity stuff. We're going to do beneficial stuff. We're going to look out for old Miss Lou. We're going to take care of her yard. We're going to take care of the eyesores. We don't need nobody outside of ourselves to take care of us or to fix us. We can do our own thing, and we can solve our own problems. We don't need police. We can police ourselves. You know what I'm saying? And that's what Hugging Your Hood is about. It's not no one thing. It's everything that got to do with us and in the hood. You know, it's a nonprofit, and it's, like I said, it's charitable. We do conflict resolution, less intention in the hood. You know, just whatever it is. It just, there's no bureaucrats, you know, to tell me what to do or what's good or what's bad. I'm enjoying what's right and forbid what's wrong. And I'm going to deal with people in the hood, and we're going to more or less create autonomous neighborhoods, and then different neighborhoods going to get together and come up and do a little treaty between this hood. We're going to create our own federation if y'all have my way.
That's great. That's awesome. And so your work, you've been doing a lot in Kansas City. Are you local to Kansas City? Is this a statewide thing where?
No, Wednesday I was in St. Louis. I got some brothers there that want to do Hug Your Hood. They like got a crew. They identifying some spots and places. Somebody just donated a 207 Odyssey luxury van to Hug Your Hood. Somebody in St. Louis. The last time I was there, somebody donated a laptop to Hug Your Hood. You know, St. Louis is down, and they ready to get down. They ready. You know, and they say I got a standing army that's ready to get down. I just got to get that more back and forth more often and help organize my problem and finances, being able to get back and forth. But the people there, is obviously they ready. They donated a van, laptop, you know, different stuff, and they ready to organize, and they ready to put on events. You know, it's just that, you know, I got to get the equipment. They want to clean up eyesores around the city, and it ain't just about cleaning up. I'm looking for high-profile stuff to do, to be visual, so people could see that we doing something visual that people can see, and the momentum, you know, and then, you know, when people see you doing stuff that they appreciate, they can hear you, they'll listen to you, you know, and then they can, you know, start resolving conflict, you know, instead of, you know, when you look better, you feel better. When your neighborhood look better, you feel better about your neighborhood, and you take care of it. You know what I'm saying? And stop trashing it, and stop letting it be a haven for violence and stuff, you know? And if people get a better understanding, you know, about how to hug your hood. I didn't bring all my stuff, but I got a whole list as to how to establish communication in the hood and different stuff you could do to hug your hood. I don't like being scripted. I'm kind of unscripted.
No, that's good. And there is no script, right? Right. It's empowering the communities to do their own work.
But I do have some curriculum to show people how to do this and do this and do this. And as to how to hook, they can use it as a format or a map. But me, I'm everything hood. You know, it encompasses, you know, creating a better living environment for everybody. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? For everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what Hugging Your Hood is. Whatever need be, somebody need to be fed, then we get a little spot where they could and pay somebody or get somebody to cook in the hood and feed. Instead, nobody got to be hungry. We got too much food. We throw away too much food for anybody to be hungry, homeless or hungry. You know, it's too many empty houses, just land that can't nobody use. And you go to jail if you live in it. You got to sit out on the street and freeze to death because this empty house, because people put property, you know, or profit over people. You know, I'm the opposite. I can't do it. I ain't going to be able to do it. Everything on this earth came out of this earth. It was here before we got here. Going to be out here after we gone. It's here for us to utilize. And to deprive people is... inhumane.
Agree. Maybe it could even be called a sin.
Yeah, that's. Yeah, we've got too many resources. It's the richest country on the planet, and then we sitting here just being selfish, and it's not about that. You know, it's not about hurting each other, and it's not about being selfish.
You know, I
used to think that if I start flip the script and start doing right, that I wouldn't be mean because I was a beast. I lay up the streets. I've been kind of like shot 17 times. And yeah, I mean, I'm saying died a few times in the process. I lived a life. I've been out there, and I used to think I would be diminished if I start doing right. Even when I was doing wrong, I wanted to do right, but I thought I would be somebody else, but it hasn't diminished me, it enhanced me. I'm bigger, better, stronger, and more efficient than ever before. I feel I'm empowered. Yeah. At first I wasn't empowered. I was taking other people's power, stealing it and robbing people of their dignity, and stuff. And now I see the light, You can only reach your full potential in a positive manner. You can never reach it negative.
Yeah. That's wonderful. And you're just shining that light on all kinds of darkness out here. And we're lucky to have you in our city.
It's going down.
Ain't
no stopping right now.
So how do people learn about Hug Yo Hood? Are there events? You have a website. Where do we point people that want more info?
See, what had happened was I'm not computer literate. When I got out, I've been locked up so long. When I got out, it was the first time I had ever seen the internet.
What?
I mean, I'm just saying. And so I'm not literate at that. There's a Hug Yo Hood Facebook page.
Yep.
But I really don't know how to man it. I got a computer now. And I'm like, I'm trying to learn. I'm trying to do what I do. At the same time, I'm trying to learn this whole new world. That's a whole new world, this computer thing. And I'm scared of that monster. But I'm like, man, somebody gonna help me man this. If I could find somebody or get some finances to hire somebody to man that computer, this would be a whole new thing. Communication is the key to success. Whoever can communicate the best will be the most successful. You know what I'm saying? And I understand that a lot of people shun that, but I embrace that. I want to communicate. And once I get the web page and then get a website and get that hooked up, that's the only thing I see stopping me is mass communication. So I'm just running around from city to city, town. I gotta be up in St. Joe, I gotta be in I was supposed to be in Jeff City this weekend and meet some people from St. Louis and Columbia and stuff in Jeff City. I ain't had no gas money, but I'm ready to go next weekend. If I have some, we're going to meet up again. But I'm saying I'm running around doing things, and I'm networking. I'm building power.
Yeah.
And it's awesome. And it ain't just me. It's more people that want to do something than it is that not. Even the people that's deemed, that people proclaim as bad, they want to do something. They want to do something different.
Yeah.
They want to do better. And this is our time. I heard from somebody somewhere. This is the decade of change. It's our time.
It is. It feels like it's a good jumping off point in 2020. And I love that you're doing the work to lay the ground, the foundation, to build the power. Things, I think, will fall in place. You're doing such great work. We have about 2 minutes. Is there anything you want to leave with? Anything that I didn't cover amongst the many things that you're involved in?
No, I don't have a script. I ain't got no commercial. It's just me. I'm just saying, I'm out here. Anybody want to do something, I'm available. Anything I can help with, I will. The only thing that I'm bound by is I do have a part-time job. It may become full-time working with the ALAD campaign. That's my job. But other than that, I'm free and I'm available, and I'll volunteer them to get involved.
Well, there you go. Well, they should meet some communications people working for the campaign. He's running for attorney general, correct?
Yeah, he's running for attorney. It's about time we elect our own attorney general. We don't pay attention to that, but I'm not promoting that on here. That's just my personal job, But I'm saying other than that, it's on and popping.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us this morning. Please check out Hug Yo Hood on Facebook. If you've got any website skills, then shoot a personal message our way and we'll get you connected to Gaddafi and we can use those skills. Thank you all for listening this morning.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Today we close out our discussion with Mr. Paul Stanford, a cannabis activist and a hell of a grower. And one last area of concern, and that is, I know that basically a little over a year ago, I think it was, the Canadian big boys in the marijuana industry took their companies to the stock market, made hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. Their stocks have gone way down as of this point, mind you. But they use those dollars they garnered from the original stock sales, and they have attempted, and in many cases are in fact taking over U.S. marijuana industry with those dollars. Am I right?
Yeah, and I've been a personal target of that. It's really pretty amazing. I don't want to harp on the individual points, but I've had a group that now is the board of directors of the Kronos Group, basically attack me, spend $2 million on lawyers to crush my work and take away earnest. Another thing I've done is I put legalization of marijuana on the ballot in Oregon. We lost in 2012, same time that Washington and Colorado won, but came back and won in 2014. But it's a long, complicated story, and I'll just leave it at that. But it's not just happening to me. The same people who attacked me are in every jurisdiction in the United States and Mexico and Latin America and Canada, you know, and they've got the big money behind them. In fact, the Kronos Group and their board of directors, Alan Friedman, Ryan Roebuck, several others, they just brought in a huge investment of $1.8 billion from the Altria Group, the owners of Marlboro Tobacco. So I'm in a battle with, you know, big tobacco and billionaires. It's pretty amazing.
Well, it is, but, that. Well, Paul, we do have to wrap it up. And, Paul, I want to thank you for, your acumen, your expertise, your willingness to educate folks around the world to the benefits and potentials. If you want to hook up with Paul, I urge you to go to his Facebook page. That is D. Paul Stanford. And other ways folks might reach you, Paul?
That's a good way. You can also go to our website, crrh.org. That's crrh.org. Our television show is streamed on Friday nights at 8 p.m. Pacific time at facebook.com/restorehim. Just facebook.com/restorehim.
I am Dean at drugtruth.net.
Sitting here in my prime, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it some way, somehow? Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD.